Fill that position, you know, the law left vacant.
It's recorded.
Oh, okay.
You've executed the deed of gift form. You understand that that's a voluntary gift to the UT Arlington Archives about significant public figures in the Mexican-American community.
Right.
And you read the terms and agreed to do this, right?
Right. I also requested a copy of the video.
And you'll get a soft copy of the transcribed
very good
video in about a year.
but the video, actual video, I can get pretty quick. Just give me the
sure.
Second.
Yeah, we can copy
right.
It.
Yeah. Now, we may have to do this in 2 seconds. I mean, I don't mind coming back.
Oh, great.
Okay.
The length of your answers will determine how long the interview goes. I know you have another commitment, so you call it quits whenever you want to.
Okay, well, about 3:45.
Okay. Why don't we start backwards in the sequence that I usually use and talk about the main reason why I wanted to interview you is that you represent one of two centers for Mexican American Studies that has been around for at least 2 decades. In your case, 25 years, and the other program in Austin, maybe just a little bit more than that. All the other centers are recent, and yours has a long, long tenure, and you've been director for a good part of it, maybe about 90% of the time of that period, more or less. So why don't you tell us the politics behind creation of these centers, why you remained a program and then want to be a department, what you contribute to the community as a center, and the highlights of this growth.
Well, the center was established in 1972. It was a student-driven center. The idea of the center was formulated by students. If you recall back in the late 60s and early 70s, the idea of creating centers, Mexican-American Studies Centers, Chicano Studies Centers in California, started floating around in the late 60s, and actually came on the heels of black demands. I don't know if you recall that period in history when across the United States in the late 60s, black students were making what they were calling black demands. More black faculty, more black students, more black-related courses. And part of their demands was a center for black studies. And the same thing happened at the University of Houston. In 1968-69, there were a group of African-American students who presented the university with a series of black demands. And we, at that time, had been talking about the development of a center ourselves. They just beat us to the punch. Plus, the university was more frightened of African-Americans than they were of us. There had been an incident on campus where black students had gone through the bookstore pulling off books and creating havoc, and so the university was very scared. Plus, there had been the assassination of Martin Luther King, burnings all across the country, black students across the United States, you know, sitting in and making demands, etc. So the University of Houston administration was very scared, in my opinion, of what was going on. So they created a committee to look at the feasibility of setting up an African-American studies program. I sat on that committee.
You already were at the university?
I was at the University of Houston as a graduate student.
Graduate?
Pursuing my master's degree. I started the University of Houston in 1962, and I got an undergraduate degree in business, and then a master's degree in sociology. So from 62 to 70, I was a student there at the University of Houston. And this is right at the latter of the last couple of years that I was there. So I sat on the committee that formulated the program, the plans to establish African American studies. Now, at the same time, I and some other students were agitating to get our program going too. In fact, they made us feel like we were doing or engaging in Me Too-ism. And in a certain sense, we were. But we felt like we had a legitimate issue. But essentially, the university said, let us set this program up first, and then once we get that up and have a model, then we'll deal with your concerns.
But let me do interrupt you. There had been a score of walkouts going back to 68 across the state of Texas, and all of those demanded the same kind of things. And I don't remember a black walkout in Texas. It was only Mexican-American walkouts throughout, demanding curriculum and faculty and teachers and things.
There were no African-American walkouts of schools. That's right. And you're right. As I'm saying, the idea of a center or ideas of center in Chicano-related courses had been floating around for quite some time. It was part of the movement. In fact, it first got started in California, as you recall. But in Texas and on our campus, the issue of the ethnic studies-related programs initially was put forth by African-Americans, formal position.
Okay.
Right? And they just beat us to the punch. That's all it was. In fact, after the black students made their presentation, they caught us in the process of us formulating a set of requests that we took to the administration, and which we took to the administration after the African-Americans took theirs. But again, it put us in a position of doing Me Too-ism. And, you know, we felt like we had been not outmaneuvered, but just, you know, they outmaneuvered us. In other words, they got there first. We weren't necessarily competing with each other, but they got there first.
Who were some of those black student leaders?
Gene Locke, Omawale, who was Dwight Allen at the time, Cheryl Locke, Mr. T, I can't remember T's last, Thompson, I think, T. Thompson. Nia Taylor was another one. There's some of the, you know, Gene Locke now is, you know, city attorney, and Omawale sits on the board of HCC. So these were some of the...
And who were some of the Mexican American leaders?
Well, it's myself, Armando Marroquin, Jorge Rangel, Lupe Lopez, Dora Ponce, Abelardo Valdez, Narciso Barrera, Ninfa Cepeda, Rosemary Garza, you know, just the group of us that were there on campus.
Okay.
Cynthia Perez and so forth and so on. So when I left the University of Houston to go off to Brown to work on my doctorate, the center had not been created yet. And the idea for a center, though, was very, very strong. So when I came back in 1974, the center had been created. And the students that sat on that committee were people like Cynthia Perez, Jaime de la Isla, Maria Jimenez, were three of the most prominent leaders in trying to get the center started. So they sat on the committee that formulated the plan. And the committee was headed by a professor out of the Spanish department by the name of Harvey Johnson, who is now dead. In fact, we went to his files trying to find a copy of the original proposal, and we couldn't find it. So Harvey Johnson chaired the committee. It had faculty members on it as well as students, but it was the students who were pushing the idea. So the students pushed the idea through, they lobbied the administration, and essentially got the program approved. And the first director was Lupe Quintanilla.
What role did George Rivera play?
George Rivera was working on his master's degree here at the University of Houston, but I think he had gone by then. I think he was gone. There were two academics, two people that went on to get their PhD, John Garcia, who is now at the University of Arizona, chair of the political science department, and George Rivera. But they were both gone by the time all of these things happened. I think John got his master's degree 65, 66. I think George Rivera got his master's somewhere 67, 68. And they were gone essentially by all the time this was going on. And so they were not an active part of what was going on. They were just several years earlier than when we had started.
Okay.
So I left, and when I came back, the center had been set up.
Lupe
Quintanilla was the director. She had been a graduate student in the Department of Education, teaching courses in Spanish. And that's how she got the position. She was on the verge of completing her dissertation. I don't know the politics behind her appointment. Some students supported her, some students didn't. But she was really the only one available at the time that had academic credentials or approaching completed academic credentials to get the program going. The catch was is that they set the program up without any funding. Now, there was no office space, there was no furniture, there were no instructors, there were nothing. And to her credit, she lobbied the administration and got office space, got furniture, got a modest budget.
Go ahead. Keep talking.
Well, you want to just cut it off?
No.
I can't talk to them.
All right, we're recording again, and you were commenting on the ability of Quintanilla to obtain furniture and some space and things.
And a modest budget for a secretary, et cetera, et cetera. And then there were two things I think she did that were very important. First, in coalition with African American Studies, a group of students went to the legislature and lobbied for some funds. And I think they got $50,000, $25,000 for African American Studies, $25,000 for Mexican-American Studies. The two principal legislators in Austin at that time who helped the students get that money were Ben Reyes and Mickey Lehman. More importantly, Dr. Quintanilla secured from the administration four or five joint appointments. It's 50% with Mexican-American Studies, 50% with the regular academic department. one in anthropology, one in sociology, one in English, one in history, and I think maybe one in education. So when I was completing my my studies, my coursework at Brown, I came back to Houston in January one time for a Christmas visit and heard about these positions, et cetera, et cetera. So I went back to Brown, completed my semester, finished my coursework, and came back to Houston and applied for one of the joint positions. And so I was the first professor hired in a joint appointment with 50% in the center and 50% in the sociology department. That, as you well know, by the article that I wrote, you know, getting tenure at the U, you know, had some repercussions for me down the line. But the lure of the position for me was, one, coming home. I didn't want to go anywhere else. Two, being at my alma mater. And three, officially having some responsibility for developing the program. Okay? In other words, I'm being told, we want you to help develop this program. So that's how we started.
Now, you got your PhD from Brown?
From Brown University.
In what year?
I think I completed the work in 1970, let's see, I came back in 74, I think it's 1978.
Okay.
1978, when I finally got my dissertation. I mean, my degree. Well, during the time, those early years there, I taught, you know, some of the first courses. I taught a course, an undergraduate course, and a graduate course called Chicano Social Issues. I taught a course in the Mexican-American family. And essentially with, you know, very little academic material there available to back me up, just, you know, whatever I could piece together, whatever I could get from California, whatever I could find in the library. I use McCary's book, you know, North of Mexico, et cetera, et cetera. And just began essentially putting together courses, as well as teaching regular courses in sociology. I began to teach race relations, and I was bringing in Mexican-Americans there, et cetera. And that's the way the program got started. I began to play a role in recruitment. I helped recruit Max Martinez to campus. I helped recruit Nick Canelos to campus, Juliano Olivares to campus, Armando Gutierrez to campus, you know. Ines Tovar was a graduate student in English, so, you know, we talked her into teaching the first Mexican-American literature course, and then when she left, Lucy Gonzalez taught it, and then, you know, we went to Max Martinez. So we, you know, I began to play all this role and then began to do things in the community and try to establish a link between the program and primarily the high schools.
Did she remain director all this time?
Yes, but she got to be a controversial director among some of us who were teaching there, primarily for a couple of reasons. One, she became the director of the bilingual education program in the College of Education. Two, she received a White House fellow. And when you're a White House fellow at that time, she could select the institution that she wanted to work at. Well, she chose to stay at the University of Houston and to work out of the president's office. So essentially, she was wearing three hats: director of Mexican-American Studies, director of bilingual education, and a White House fellow working out of the president's office. And so that meant then that less attention was paid to the program and more attention paid to what she was doing out of the president's office. But she was very influential on campus because she was working out of the president's office. I remember one time, for example, we complained about the lack of attention being paid to the program, and we had a candidate that we wanted to hire, somebody with a master's degree. We wanted to hire to teach a lecture course or something. I can't recall who that was, but Dr. Quintanilla opposed it. So we took the situation to the dean. And it was Dean Giles at the time. Well, he shot us down and supported her. Well, that had the tendency to alienate us, but it also told us how influential she was with the dean and everybody else. And she was good in the public relations sense. Another thing that I remember, we used to have the meetings, the faculty, the meetings, would have them there in her office, adjacent to the president's office. And we saw her do some things that really helped us in terms of solidifying our opposition to her, is all I may say that. Now that I look back on it, for example, top administrators would come to office, would come to their, come to work in the mornings, and Dr. Quintanilla would get up, and she would have these little tacos wrapped up in aluminum paper, and she'd go give them the tacos, and they'd practice their Spanish, buenos dias, you know, and they'd laugh and joke, you know. Well, you know, to those of us who thought we were more radical than Karl Marx, you know, that was really, you know, it really would turn us off, you know. Of course, you know, I have since softened my views toward Dr. Quintanilla, and with hindsight, and then being the director, appreciate what she did, you know, fighting for funds and getting the program started and getting those positions.
Taco politics.
That's right, that's right. But she was in her own way.
As opposed to the politics of Taco Mignola.
That's right.
Maybe you'll tell us that story.
That's right, right. You know, so now I appreciate in her own way, she got the program started and off the ground. And she was also very influential with the administration. But she did some things that alienated everybody. Like, for example, having the mayor declare it Mexican-American Studies Day, which was good for publicity and so forth and so on. But she created an impression that the program was much stronger than it really was. Okay? And so that began to bring some problems to her doorstep with the students, primarily. And so students then began to become dissatisfied with her leadership, et cetera, et cetera. And so then she finally just had enough of the politics, you know, and she was really being pulled in three different directions, trying to run the bilingual education program and get that off the ground, doing her politics as a White House fellow, and then putting up with us via Mexican-American Studies.
Who is us at that time? I know you mentioned all the people you recruited, but
Well, by this time, Armando Gutierrez is on campus, Margarita Melville is on campus in anthropology, Max Martinez is in English department. We were the principal faculty at that time. And then there were a whole series of other folks that taught, community folks that taught in the program initially, who were still lingering around. Luis Cano, David Lopez, who was sitting on the school board, Leonel Castillo. These were all folks who, you know, were teaching part-time in the program. Juan Flores, who went up to Dallas as an administrator of some in education. But essentially, as we got full-time faculty there, their role and influence began to diminish because they were part-time and we were on campus all the time. And then at this time, of course, Mayo and Mujeres Unidas and the student group were very active and strong and going, you know. And there was a social club, an organization called Las Tecas, you know. So it was very active around that period of time.
Is this the mid-70s?
Yes, yes. 74, 75, 76, Borai, you know. And when I got on campus, of course, because I had been on campus before, had been active on campus before, I was kind of like a catalyst for the protests. You know, I had always students coming to me, you know, complaining about this and complaining about that, and we didn't have this. And that's how I got involved in recruiting and things of this nature. So then Dr. Quintanilla resigns. You know, she had had enough. And Margarita Melville becomes the director. This is 1979, I think. About 79. But then she's getting ready to come up for tenure. So, and she wants to devote more time to publishing and meeting that obligation. So then she resigns. And then we had Victor Cisneros Nelson, who we brought in interim, 1 year, for the directorship. But we were conducting a search. And Nick Canelos interviewed. That's the way we hired Nick. There was some opposition to Nick because he was a Puerto Rican. But we liked Nick as a scholar. We liked him as a person. So we talked to the Spanish department, and they saw his credentials, and they were very much interested. And Nick was glad to just go to the Spanish department. And Nick and principal agreed that, you know, it should be a Mexican-American in Texas, et cetera. We interviewed Alfredo Mirandez. We had some problems with Alfredo. The administration, the sociology department didn't want to hire him. We tried to get him placed in social work, and Mirandez didn't want that, so that fell through. And so nobody knew what to do. And so then that's when my name surfaced as a director. And I wanted the job, but I just didn't want the job so quickly, you know, because I was in this tenure battle. But no one else wanted the job. Armando Gutierrez and other folks, you know, impressed upon me, you know, that I had to take it and so forth and so on. So I took it. And that's how we started. And I took it, and it was me and a part-time secretary, Linda, I can't recall her name, who hardly ever showed up.
Well, tell us about the tenure fight before you start off on your career, because that is important. I know there's an article, you mentioned it, but tell us what went on and your views as to why this happens. I think at that time you were one of three or four very prominent figures who were denied tenure. The one other one that comes to mind is Jesus Chavarria, now publisher of Hispanic Business.
Well, in my judgment, there were two issues. There was the issue of Roz Dworkin in my department, who was the wife of the ex-chair in the department, Gary Dworkin. She was coming up for tenure when I was. The second issue was, of course, the joint appointment, which is where the issue really revolved around. But in my judgment, it was politics. And so people in the department were trying to get me to delay my tenure consideration for 1 year and let Roz go forward. And that was essentially what their strategy was, try to get Thatcher out of the way, because they couldn't tenure both of us. Why, I don't know. They defined the situation as that two people are coming up for tenure, but only one of them is going to get it. And Roz Dworkin, of course, was part of the clique that was running the department. Gary Dworkin had been the chair. Janet Chavitz was the chair. I mean, Alan Haney was the chair at this time. And Janet Chavitz and other folks in the department, they were all just a little group who hung around together, not only in the department, but socially as well. So they were personal friends. And so I got the inkling when the chair of the department called me in during the summer and said he was worried about my chances for getting tenure, and he thought that I should seek a delay for 1 year. And I went back, and I took his advice very seriously, but I went back and reviewed my record, and I thought, you know, I was in good shape, assuming that I was going to get evaluated properly, 50% Mexican-American studies, 50% in the department, because I had three or four articles published, one of them in one of the primary journals of sociology, social problems, which I thought, you know, everybody told me counted for two or three, you know, because it was a privilege to get published in that journal. So I went back to the chair and told him, no, I want to go ahead and come up for tenure on my, you know, when I was scheduled to. Later on in the summer, he called me back in and said, well, he had had more conversations with people around the administration of the department. He was really, really worried about my tenure, and he really wanted me to get it, that maybe I should just seek tenure in another department. And I said, in another department? He says, yes, like social work. So that, you know, and so that didn't ring very well with me, you know. So then I knew something fishy was coming up. My mental set shifted from here's Alan, who's very concerned about me, Alan Haney, to now they're trying to push me aside. And so I began to talk to people in the department about what was going on, my allies. And Bill Simon, who was my closest ally, told me, no, that there had been meetings going on. He hadn't been privy to the meetings. But the rumor was they was trying to figure out some way to keep me up going to tenure so that Roz would come up and would get tenure by herself. And on the other hand, the little clique had opposition in the department. There were people who favored me over Roz. And so then I went back to Alan and told him what I thought. Told him there was politics going down, that it wasn't going to be fair, that I was going to fight it all the way. And so he backed off and left me alone. I came up for tenure. I was denied Mexican-American studies, votes to grant me tenure. The Department of Sociology votes to deny me tenure. But the department also voted in a very close vote, and all our votes were close, to deny Roz Dworkin tenure as well. So she didn't get tenure, and I didn't get tenure. And I never will forget, after the vote, I was in my office, and Roz Dworkin came by and said, I'm sorry you didn't get tenure, et cetera, et cetera. She said, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I'm going to fight it. I've already got an attorney. In fact, during the summer, I had already hired an attorney. I said, I'm going to fight it. I'm going to get an attorney because, you know, they didn't take into consideration the nature of my joint appointment. It's clear to me, you know. And Roz, she says, well, I'm not going to fight it. I'm going to be very professional about this. That's implying that I wasn't professional because I was going to, if they don't want me, I don't want them, she said. And I said, well, Roz, you know, up to you, but I'm going to fight it. And in a way that helped me that she got out of the way. So I fought it.
Who was your attorney?
It was a guy named Henry Rosenblum. Okay? He was my first attorney. And he was the one who was advising me all the way.
All right, we're recording again.
My attorney was Henry Rosenblum. Yeah. I initially considered David Lopez, but I had some sort of advice that David was inaccessible, that he was very expensive. And so Frank Alvarez recommended this guy, Henry Rosenblum, who had handled cases. And Henry was very good.
Were you in state court or federal court?
I wasn't in court yet.
Okay.
I wasn't in court. We hadn't filed a suit yet. So I had several meetings with Henry, and it was in my discussions with Henry when I came up with the idea that we had to fight this, that the university couldn't have it both ways, that they couldn't put me in a dual position And then at time of tenure, ignore 50% of my appointment and only consider the other 50%. And so Henry helped me draft it up. And he thought it was an ingenious strategy. So then one day I get a call from Henry, though, and he says he has to meet with me. It was a Sunday. He says, I have to meet with you this Sunday. So I go over to his office early Sunday morning. He's there drinking scotch and water out of a University of Texas cup. And he says that he can't guarantee that he will be able to see my case to conclusion, that he's had some personal issues come up and that he's just going to have to get out of some of his legal obligations, and that my case was young enough, we hadn't moved far enough because the administrative procedures at the university had not yet exhausted themselves, and that he wasn't sure that he'd be able to see my case to all the way through the end. So essentially what he was telling me is find yourself another lawyer. Well, I was kind of devastated because I had already gotten close to Henry. You know, I could talk to him. He was very accessible. I could call him at a drop of the hat.
You already paid money.
Yeah, I paid him a little money. Not much, but a little money, you know. And so he says, I know of a lawyer that he will take, who used to defend institutions against guys like you. He says, in fact, that's how I know him, because he's usually kicking my ass in court. He says, but now he's in private practice. And he's taking on plaintiffs' cases. And I don't know if he'll take your case on because, you know, he's usually representing the institutions. But if he will, he's probably the best in the business. And I said, who is that? And he said, it was David Feldman.
Feldman?
Feldman, F-E-L-D-M-A-N. So why don't you give David a ring? So I said, okay. So Henry and I severed our relationship. And I called David, told him that I had been recommended by Henry. And Henry, in fact, told me, I'm going to call David and tell him about your case. So David said, yes. David says, he tells me that you have a very interesting case, an unusual case. He says, I'd like to talk to you about it. So I said, okay. So I went down and took David all my files, essentially explained to him what the situation was. And he was intrigued by the argument, dual positions, so forth and so on. So he said, I'll take your case. He says, but this is what I want you to do. Number one, I want you to get you a diary, get you a book or something, and I want you to write down every recollection you can have. Because what you've told me about what people, about Haney calling you in and all of this and all of that, and somebody warning you that there's a strategy to move you out, he says, I want you to write all of that down. And from here on out, every time you have a conversation about your tenure case, I don't care how insignificant it is, I don't care if you have it in somebody's office or in the bathroom, I want you immediately to go and record it and keep a journal. He says, because this is extremely important that any conversation you have, and he says, in fact, if you can engage those faculty members in your department that voted against you in conversations, he says, the better it is. But just keep a record. He says, and I want to meet with you. He says, I want to do some research. He says, and I want to meet with you in another week or so. He says, and I want to talk to you about your case. I said, okay. So I immediately went and made all my recollections and so forth and so on, and I met with him again. And when I met with him again, he had a legal pad, and he had drawn a line right down the middle. And on one side, he had all of the reasons that he thought were in my favor, and all of the reasons that he thought were against me. And at the bottom, he had percentage on the percentage that he thought that I could, you know, the probability that I would win. Well, then he showed me the pad. And on the right-hand side that had all the reasons against me, he had more reasons than the reasons I had for me. And the percentages were 60 probably lose, 40% chance of winning. And he said that was his honest assessment. But he also made it very clear that this is what his thinking was at that point. He didn't know what discovery was going to lead to, et cetera, et cetera. And we talked about cost.
Had you ever been in court before?
Never.
So you had no idea what you were getting?
No. Well, David told me. David told me he cited some statistics.
David Lopez?
No. David Feldman.
David Feldman.
Yeah, he cited some statistics. Because one of the reasons he had going against me was, one, judges do not like to substitute their judgment for the judgment of peers. He says, fortunately, in your case, they are not getting you on the quality of your stuff. They're getting you on the quantity, right? So they're not saying that your stuff is not good. They're saying, in fact, they're saying your stuff is very good. You just haven't done enough of it. He says, now, that's good. It's a very subtle distinction. But the judge is not going to come in and say, my opinion as a judge is that Thatcher's work is a good sociologist. He'll deflect to the peers. On the other hand, judges don't like to go against what they see as experts making judgment on one of their peers. So that was kind of a gray area, but he put it against me because he wasn't sure. Another statistic he cited me was all of the cases in the last 10 years that had been lost by people going to courts. It just was very, very difficult to prove discrimination. On the other hand, on the other side of the page, I wasn't alleging personal discrimination. I was alleging institutional discrimination by putting me in this joint appointment. I wasn't alleging that Janet and all of them were prejudiced against me because I was a Mexican. I was just alleging that no one else except minorities had these joint appointments. We were wrong on that point. So then he says, but you know, we don't know what discovery. Then we talked about costs. And he told me he would handle my case for $15,000. But, I would have to do a lot of the research. That if he had to go out, when we went through discovery, because what he wanted to do was to, through discovery, subpoenaed all of the university's records dealing with all tenure cases from the time I had been hired to the present. Okay? If he did that, that meant that he was going to have to hire someone, he was going to have to do it, or he was going to have to hire someone to go through all those records. That if I was willing to do that myself, and he'd show me what to look for, then he could do the case for $15,000. He says, I want to do your case, but I just can't.
That's still a lot of money at that time. Though.
Was a lot of money. 79, 80, what I, you know. So I agreed. I said, yeah, it's great. I mean, I liked his, first of all, I liked it because he didn't bullshit me. He was right up front. These cases are hard to win, et cetera. But on the other hand, I'm intrigued by your particular case because of this joint appointment situation. So we started. So that was the first break, I think. Getting someone like David, who told me to keep the journal because the journal came in very, very handy. You'd be surprised some of the stuff that people told me. And I kept records of it, and we were going to subpoena all these folks. That was the first break. The second break I had is when we finally went to file the lawsuit. Now, as you know, as an attorney, federal judges have areas of jurisdiction. And they circulate. So you're handling discrimination, you're handling drugs or whatever, right? Then after a while, you know, the discrimination moves over to drugs and so forth and so on. So you go down and you file the lawsuit. The clerk draws a card from the judge, from the list of judges in your area at random, and you peel off the tape that's on it, and you got the judge's name on it. It's got your case. So I never will forget, you know, we finally got all the paperwork, the argument down. David and I went over it about this institutional discrimination. You couldn't have it both ways. And I never will forget, Armando Gutierrez drove me down to the courthouse. I mean, he was circling the block. Well, I ran up there to file the lawsuit. Went up there, got the card, tore the tape off. It was Judge James DeAnda. I mean, I felt like screaming.
Second Mexican-American appointed in the Southern District.
That's right. And David had told me, with any luck, we'll get DeAnda, right? And while DeAnda's a hard ass in some cases and so forth and so on, in this particular area, I know from going up with him, he's got some, you know, some sensibilities and some sensitivity because he used to file against educational institutions, his law school. He knows how the institutions will drag their feet on information and so forth and so on, okay?
Where'd you get the money?
Well, I borrowed it. My wife and I have barred
fundraisers?
No, I had no fundraisers. I had some money.
Didn't want to or didn't try?
Well, there were some students that wanted to, you know, this is another piece of advice that David told me. There was a lot of students that wanted to make my case, you know, let's protest, let's go sit in the president's office, let's go and so forth and so on.
Did you consider Maldiv?
No. Why? Well, like I say, once I found David, I mean, just Maldiv just never even came up as I was satisfied with Henry. Henry was good. You know, my thing was being able to sit and talk with an attorney and something happens, what should I do? And Henry was very accessible. David was very accessible. Plus, I could tell that David liked me personally. I got along with him. Plus, he was very knowledgeable about how institutions act. And so he told me, because I had students and I had political connections and so forth and so on. And he told me, no. That's you. And I tell him, I got the students, they want to march, they want to throw that. He says, well, my advice, no. I don't want you doing that. He said, because, doctor, the worst thing you can do is back the university up against the wall. I know what they'll do. If you start giving them bad publicity, they may want to compromise and give you something. He says, and we don't want to back them up. At the appropriate time, we'll do it. So I was walking a thin line between the students who thought I was scared and didn't want to do it, and my attorney who's giving me the advice. And I'm following, I'm doing what my attorney's telling me, right? That's the other agreement. He said, you're going to have to do what I tell you. So we're walking a thin line. Well, the case goes on and on and on. In the meantime, the university does something that really helped my case. Because of the controversy and because the students are still agitating them over there, they eliminate joint appointments. Now remember, I'm the director. I'm the director of the program at this time. They eliminate joint appointments. And I get into an administrative struggle with the administration because I'm said, fine, I think it's great if you eliminate joint appointments, except I want to hold on to that 50%. And they were saying, no, we want to give it to the departments and it's all these positions. And I said, no, well, I want out. So that increased my budget a little bit. The more important thing, by eliminating joint appointments, the university was admitting that they did not work. Okay, and so again, this is something that I told David. He said, great, he was happy, I was happy, and we kept waiting. So then we get to the point of discovery. And this is where Deonda's role begins to assume more importance. We go in with a list of everything. We want all tenure cases across the university from the time I was hired to present. The university goes in and says, chemistry and English, they're irrelevant to Dr. Mendiola. He should be entitled only to the tenure cases out of his department from the time he was hired to president, which was a grand total of 3. Okay? Well, Deonda ruled on my behalf. Right? That was the first break. Okay? So, I mean, the university was hot. First of all, their records were in disarray. Second of all, they had to give me access to them. Okay? It just so happened that all the tenure cases were in the provost's office, okay? And so I told David, I said, I don't want to sit in his office and go through these cases. And so he worked it out. They took all the tenure files, put them in a room adjacent to the provost's office. And then I had access to them. They locked me up in a room so the provost couldn't see me there going, you know, him getting pissed off every time he saw me there. And it was Magner who was the provost.
George Magner. Now vice president, huh?
No, he's provost again. He's provost again. He was a provost at this time. So that's what I did. This decision was made somewhere in late November, so I spent my entire Christmas holidays going through those records. I mean, spending there all day long. But man, what an education. It was like, it's like looking at people's underwear. You know, it's like going to somebody's drawer or going through their hamper and looking at underwear. Well, what I was looking for was, of course, joint appointments, especially how joint appointments, the paperwork revealed treatment of joint appointments in Mexican-American studies and in African-American studies and anywhere else that I found evidence of joint appointments. And this is essentially where we built our case. Because when you looked at Mexican-American studies and especially African-American studies, you have a whole history of conflict over hiring. The program's wanting to hire somebody else, the department's saying no. Or the department's wanting to hire someone, the program's saying no. You had disputes over salary, with the program wanting to give so much, the department's saying no, or vice versa. Then you had a whole series of conflicts just over jurisdiction and courses. But especially with African American studies, the documents that I reviewed revealed a much more acrimonious relationship between African-American studies and regular departments and administration than between us and the regular departments. But nevertheless, it was there. Disputes over salary and who should be hired and who shouldn't be hired and courses and who had authority over the professor, et cetera, et cetera. On the other hand, other joint appointments between chemical engineering and chemistry, or English and German, or Italian and English, or one of the sciences in history, or business in history. These are joint appointments, revealed a different pattern. The exchange of letters, cordial, working things through, prior agreement on who's to be hired, prior agreements on salary. I mean, it was like black and day. We built essentially our case. There was no question. And I went through all of the documents, and we had a very clear-cut pattern. But the ethnic studies programs and their joint appointments were fraught with conflict, especially those in African American studies, whereas joint appointments among other departments, and there were minor disputes, but there were nothing compared to what we found. Okay? So we went through all of those documents. Time goes on, you know, 4 or 5 years goes on. People are making mistakes. And I'm recording everything. People are making comments. Then the university says they want to settle. Okay? We said, okay, we'll settle. When do I get tenure? They said, no. We want to keep, we realize now how valuable Dr. Mendiola is to us, and we want to keep him in an administrative position. That if he'll drop his case against us, we will retain his services as the director of Mexican American Studies, but he will be an administrator, and he can continue to teach.
At will.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I that was unacceptable to me. I said, no. So we came back with a counteroffer. In the meantime, because I had sued the university, the chair of the department will not let me teach in the department. So we amended the lawsuit to include a charge of retaliation. Okay. So we came back then with a counterproposal saying Dr. Mendiola will remain an administrator, but he will come up for tenure in 5 years or 4 years, I think it was 3 years from that point on. If he doesn't get tenure, then he will continue to be evaluated for tenure every 3 years until he gets it. And that's it, you know. And he will be allowed to go back and teach. I mean, it was a jewel of a contract. And I was very, very hesitant, but David kept saying, damn, Thatcher, you know, you're going to be reviewed for tenure until you get it. And he had written in there that my administrative duties had to be taken into consideration, evaluated by other administrators, and so forth and so on. It was a jewel of a contract. It was perpetual, you know, it was perpetual. Well,
that's what I meant by at will. The other one, they could fire you at the end of the contract year or any time.
That's right. Well, Bishop turned me down.
Who's Bishop?
He was President Ed Bishop at the time. He was president of the university at the time. There was no chancellor system at that time. He turned it down and said, if Dr. Mendiola wants to remain here, this is it. He's got a 5-year contract as administrator, subject to renewal upon, you know, approval. No tenure consideration, nada. You know, well, I turned it down. Turned it down. I said, well, we're going to move forward then. Okay, move forward. Then, while all of this is going on, I'm also lobbying, trying to get a line item. I'm working with Roman Martinez in the meantime, has been elected state representative.
What year is that?
Roman first gets elected in 1980. He gets elected in 82, I guess it's 83. So Roman, I'm working with Roman trying to get the line item, et cetera, right? And, you know, it's hard to get these damn line items. Roman is helping me a lot. And so then Roman begins to hear, after we secure the line item, he begins to hear people are telling him, hey, the doctor will settle his tenure thing. And I hadn't told Roman anything. So he calls me up one day and says, well, you have some tenure problems, Thatcher? So I said, yeah. So we met, and I told him the whole story, you know, who the lady. And he wanted to get involved. He wanted to get involved. So again, I go back to David. David, you know, Roman is willing. You know, he sits on the Appropriations Committee. He told me he's willing. You know, and I know he will, because I've worked with him in the line item. I've heard the way he talks to the president. He's got balls. He doesn't mind, you know, telling the president what he has to do. And David said, nope. Hold him off. Great. Tell him we appreciate it. I'll talk to him if you want to, but this is not the time, Thatcher. Let's let this thing, you know, we got him. You know, we'll just let it go forward. We'll use the political stuff when it's necessary. So the case moves forward. A year later, it's during Super Bowl time, we get notice that the trial is going to be set, and you have to submit these documents. Both sides have to submit their evidence, right? There are no surprises in federal court. The other side submits their evidence. We submit our evidence. And I remember we was working through the holidays again. It was a Super Bowl Sunday because David had the television on and the sound was down. And we were up there and he was drafting up his statement of facts. Okay? And he had the other attorney on the line. His name was Kevin from the state that's representing the university. Hanson, is it? Hanlon? Kevin Hanlon or something like that. He was on the phone. Okay? So they're going back and forth. So David, we finally get our statement of facts, and David is reading the statement of facts and what he can agree on and what they can't agree on. And I never will forget this, because I'm just sitting there watching the football game by this time. And I never will forget, David hangs up the phone, he called me back in his office. I was in a little outer office. He says, you know what? I said, well, he says, I think I just won your case for you. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, the guy agreed that you were put in an untenable position when I showed him all the stuff about African American and all the conflict, he agreed, you know. He says, you know, the only thing he disagrees on is that you should be given tenure. He said, "But I, he says I'm flabbergasted. I don't know if he knows what the hell I said." He said,
"But what he's doing?"
Yeah, he says, "I just think I won your case for you." He says, "I'm going to call him back on Monday or Tuesday next week and make sure that he understands." So David called him back, and sure enough, the guy says, "You know what, David?" He says, "I'm going to recommend to the university that they settle." He says, "You know, if we're going to court, I'm afraid the university is going to lose this one." So, man, I mean, I'm happy as hell. David is happy, and we go to the university. He calls the university's attorney up, tells him, you know, what the situation is. The attorney doesn't know what the hell is going on. He gets involved in it. He looks at all the documents, and he goes back and tells the president. Says the recommendation from the attorney general's office at the university settled to grant document the old attorney. The president says no. He says no. Okay. So what do you mean, no? He says, no, I'm going to take this to court, the integrity of the system, of the review process, and this and this and that, you know. So then I go back and tell David. David says, this guy's, he's foolish. What's the matter with him? He's got the attorney general. He's got his own lawyers. He's got everybody telling him he won't do it. He says, it's time to do the politics. What do you think you can do? He says, well, I'm going to go talk to Roman and so forth and so on. So I go back and I talk to Roman, explain to him. Roman hit the ceiling. Roman says, let me make sure I understand. You know, this attorney general telling to settle, the university attorney telling to settle, the president won't. He said, no. He says, well, do you mind if I call the attorney general? I said, no. He said, but look, check with David. You'll go through David. Roman and David talk. Roman calls the attorney general, speaks to him directly. He says, yes, I'm recommending that the university settle this case. So Roman then comes back to me and says, I want to take this matter before the caucus. Okay.
The Mexican-American Legislative Caucus.
Legislative Caucus. I said, fine. He says, well, we got a meeting scheduled. He says, it'll be about 30, 40 days. We've got a meeting scheduled. He says, just keep it under wraps. I'm going to tell him. Fine. You're in the meantime. This is rodeo time now. Remember, this is Super Bowl time. The rodeo is coming, and all of the legislators are coming to Houston, the Mexican-American legislators, to go to the rodeo. And somebody's bought them front seat tickets and this and that. And I'm leveraging for the line item again. So I arrange this luncheon between the president and the Mexican-American Legislative Caucus. Right, and by this time, I have been to Mexico with the president, that program we had running with the Colegio de Mexico. We have spent time together, you know, and so forth. The whole bit, he knows who I am, I know who he is. He knows about the tenure thing, but, you know, it's kind of always in the background. We never talk about it. So this is when the president then, and I'm trying to put him in the best possible light in front of the legislators, so I introduce him. And I say, you know, all these trips that we've made to Mexico and how supportive he's been and the funds that he's made available and how he's hosted it and so forth. And that's when the president goes up there and says, and I introduce him, President Ed Bishop, and I give him a nice round of applause. He goes up to the podium and he says, thank you, Taco. You know? And there's a slight ripple, you know, and everybody's looking at each other. And then the president launches into his speech about the university's need for faculty dollars, the university's need for research dollars, the university's need for building dollars. When he gets through, that's about 10 or 15 minutes, then he shifts his attention to recruitment. That the downtown campus has so many Hispanics, and that we have so many Hispanics here, it doesn't look as well. He says, but Taco's been doing a great job, you know, right? Second time. By this time, everybody's... And he says, and also I know that Taco is not going to let me out of the room without mentioning his line item. And Taco, yeah, so he talked with me to death about four or five times. And by this time, the laughter is, you know, I can see that some of them, like Gonzalo Barrientos, he's leaning over and talking and people are buzzing. So Al Luna interrupts him.
Al Luna is another Houston legislator.
Right. Al Luna.
Second Mexican-American.
That's right. That's right. County. And at this time, chair of the Mexican-American Legislative Caucus. So Al Luna interrupts him and says, it's Tacho, it's not Taco. And the president says, beg your pardon? He says, it's Tacho, not Taco. And the university is not going to give us appropriations next time until you learn how to say it correctly. So everybody just laughed and a half applaud and so forth and so on, you know.
His
face turned red. He said, oh, I beg your pardon. His face turned red. But he finished his speech by reading it and got a very light round of applause. When he's leaving the podium, I'm walking back up because I'm hosting. And he shakes my hand. He says, I'm very sorry about that. And I said, that's okay. Don't worry about it. So then I got up to the mic. And, of course, the room was just, you could hear a fart. You know? And I tried to let the old man off the hook. I said, I don't want the president to feel embarrassed for mispronouncing my name. You know, it's not a common name, and many people have mispronounced it. In fact, I lived next door to a man for 25 years who called me Tojo. You know, and everybody just laughed. I mean, the tension was let out of the air, and that was it.
But how did you really feel about all this? What's going on?
Well, at the time that he made the blunder, I thought it was in my favor. I mean, I thought it was in my favor. The first thing I mean, the lawsuit and the tenure thing was never far from my mind. And so I thought, now they know, now they will remember who he is. And sure enough, you know, 3 weeks, 4 weeks down the line, they were getting ready to meet again. They're on the legislative agenda. Romanus got on the agenda. They discuss all their things. And then my thing is the last thing that Roman brings up. And people are saying, so you got a tenure case down there against Thatcher, and who's the president? And Roman said, Bishop. And who's Ed Bishop? You know, the guy that called, that son of a bitch, you know. Right? So then the legislative caucus got involved in the issue. So by this time, this is April, the university's budget is in the Appropriations Committee, and it becomes an issue. Roman is threatening to tag it, to delay it. And he tells the other members, you know, we've got this situation over there where the Attorney General and all the attorneys are telling the President to settle this case, and he won't settle it. And, you know, many African Americans got into it. You know, it's a blatant example of racism. Al Luna wrote him a very strongly worded letter. You know, and I didn't tell him to do it. He just got pissed off. And he wrote him a very strongly worded letter saying our efforts to make progress, you know, are impeded by people like you, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the president then begins to relent. And he comes back and says, okay, I'm going to allow you to be reviewed for tenure again. This time we will take into consideration the joint appointment. And my attorney says, no, no deal. How many times are you going to stab this guy? Review him again, correct your mistake, and deny him again? No. So I said, no, won't do it, won't do it. And the president, well, you know, Mendiola is not cooperating. By this time, Republicans have gotten in the issue, like Senator Don Henderson, calls the president and tells him, you know, this is getting to be serious up here. The university, and you in particular, are developing this reputation as being anti-minority. You know, because of your inflexibility. So then the president comes back and says, okay, I'm going to grant Dr. Mendiola tenure, and I'm going to set up a special committee to review his credentials, and he's going to have tenure in Mexican-American studies. Now, what the hell was that? Only departments grant tenure, right? Now, that was a close one for me. There's a lot more pressure on me about that one. I'm running back and forth, and I talk to several people, and Armando and them are saying, shit, no, don't take it, you know. Don't take it. Margarita Economist says, you know, what is tenure in Mexican-American studies? There's no tenure in Mexican-American studies. It's second-class tenure.
Sure, and the program could also be eliminated from when you're the next.
And I'm gone. No, that's right. So, but the term second-class tenure struck a bell with me. So I relayed, you know, Roman, the president, I said no. I sent word back to the attorney. No, I didn't want tenure. I wanted tenure in the sociology department. So the president then relays the word back to the caucus that I was turning down his offer of tenure. So Roman calls me up and says, I just heard your turn. I says, no, and I explained to him what it was. And he says, well, what's the matter with that? I said, Roman, you know, we're a program. Only departments grant tenure. It's second-class tenure. So he took that back to the caucus. And, of course, they latched on it right away. Why is his tenure any different from the other one? So then, by this time, you know, the pressure is really mounted. The budget is stalled. It's becoming more and more public. You know, more and more legislators are hearing about it. The press is calling me, etc. But I'm not talking to the press yet. David says, not yet. You know, let's play this thing out. Bill Hobby is being apprised of the situation. This is when we bring Mr. McGrew in. And we deliberately let Bill Hobby know what's going on. He was the lieutenant general. He's getting involved in it. So finally, the pressure is too great for the president. And he says, okay, Mendiola's got tenure in the sociology department. That's it. But I will not promote him from assistant to associate. And so, you know, it's a big victory. David Feldman is glad. My family's glad. The students are glad. We go out and we party and this and this and that. But I'm remembering Dr. Quintanilla. They tenured her as an assistant And only in the last few years has she been promoted to associates. I'm thinking, you know, these guys are going to keep me an assistant professor here for the rest of my life. You know, and that's nagging me. It's nagging me. And people can't understand why I won't accept the tenure. And so David is pissed off at me. So I finally calm him down. I go to his office and I explain to him. I said, David, you know, this, the promotion associate, I should get it, man, because these guys are going to screw me the rest of my career there. I'll never be an associate professor unless I get it now. And so David said, well, can we get any figures on that? I said, any figures on what? He says, on how many people are promoted from assistant to associate when they get tenure. I said, yeah, let's get some figures.
That's about 100%.
Huh? Well, it was 90%.
Quintanilla being the 10th.
Yeah, right. There's a few that didn't. There's a few that weren't, right? So we get those statistics, right? But it's a delicate situation, all right? So David says, well, this is what we'll do. If you'll recall, we had already met with the judge. We were set for trial. Deonda had another trial that had spilled over. And so Deonda was going to delay it. But the clerk, the honest clerk, was a good friend of David's. Okay, so David arranged a meeting with Deonda that he wanted to know if Deonda wouldn't mind relaying his opinion to everybody concerned in light of the Attorney General recommending that the case be settled. And so the clerk helped us. He reviewed the case, gave Deonda his opinion, Deonda is so. We met with Deonda in an informal meeting, the university and us. And Deonda apologized for not being able to go to trial on schedule. And he said, however, I wanted to let both sides know my thinking on this case at this point. And then he looked over at the university and says, it appears that Dr. Mendiola has a meritorious case. And I would hope that the two sides could sit down and settle this so that we won't waste the taxpayers' money, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? Then the last thing he said was, keep me informed. Okay, well, it was that sentence that we relied on to get it to take the issue of the promotion. So David says, okay, if we go before Deonda, he says, I'm going to get the university, maneuver another meeting on this, see if I can use my contacts to get another meeting with Deonda. He says, but you're going to have to agree, Thatcher, to go along with whatever Deonda says. If I go to the university and tell them, let's take the matter before the judge, if he says you have to compromise, he says you're going to have to eat it. And I said, well, at least I can say the judge made me do it, right? And I don't have to, the university forced me into it. Fine. We go to Deonda's, you know, and we said, well, you know, what's the status of the case? That's the way he starts. And the university says, well, we're now willing to tenure Dr. Mendiola. And he says, well, what's wrong with that? What's the purpose of this meeting? And then David stands up and says, well, the issue is promotion. He says, what do you mean promotion? He says, well, it's generally the granting of tenure comes with promotion to associate professor. Dr. Mendiola is an assistant, and the university doesn't want to. Then the university stood up and says, we think that's a matter for his peers to decide. And Deonda says, well, in how many cases do people normally get tenure? And Dave stood up and said, 90%.
You mean tenure and promotion?
And tenure and promotion.
So does Deonda know the question to ask?
Yeah, yeah. But, I mean, that's a logical question, you know. And then the university said they objected and said, no, the figure was too high. It wasn't 90%. And so then the judge asked him, he says, well, then what is the percentage? And he says, well, it's more like 75. I don't even think he knew. And the judge says, 75. And he says, well, that's still very high, isn't it? He says, yes, sir, it is, but there's 25% that don't get it, you know. And so Deonda looked at the university, looked at us, and he says, well, if by your own admission, 75% of people who are granted tenure are promoted from assistant to associate, in my judgment, that's very high, and the court cannot allow Dr. Mendiola or any other professor to be treated differently. He says, and if the matter comes before me for settlement, that's the way I'll rule. So I think Dr. Mendiola should be granted promotion, and I hope Ejona can work it out. Are there any other issues? No. And the university attorney started protesting, and he made Deonda mad. But you don't understand, sir. The president is adamant. He believes that he's compromised by granting Dr. Mendiola tenure. He feels that Dr. Mendiola now has to compromise. And Deonda stood up, signaling that the meeting was over with, and he says, well, you tell your president that if he's looking for a scapegoat, that it's Judge Deonda. And that was it.
The devil made me do it.
That was it. Yeah, that's it. He stood
You're
up.
Thinking exactly.
That's right. That's right.
The judge
it.
Made me do it.
That's it. He stood up. He stood up. And we walked outside. And we all sat at a table, but Magner and them were still saying, no, they didn't know, you know. And I got so mad that David had to pull me out of there. And he said, just get the hell out of here, Pastor, just go on home. Because I got so mad, I said, y'all hear all this stuff, and y'all are still going to go back to the president and so forth and so on. And David just grabbed me by the arm and said, come here, come here. He said, we got him. Get the hell out of here. You know, don't, none of this emotional stuff. Just get the hell out of here. Go on home.
Did you?
Yeah. No, we didn't have a beer.
Okay.
So I left. You know, I left. And hell, man, I think the next day, the next afternoon, I got a letter from Bishop saying I had been granted tenure, promoted to associate professor, retroactive, back to the time that I was considered tenure, before it had taken 5 years.
So that was a handsome check, because you also probably got attorney's fees.
Got attorney's fees.
Plus back pay.
Right. By that time,
merit raises.
Right. By that time, I had given David $13,000. And he gave my $13,000 back. Or he made a good fee, but he gave me my $13,000 back. I got some pay. You know, you're right. No, it was, you know.
You had a second beer.
That's right. That's right.
Well, how did this impact positively and negatively where we left off the story, that you got to be the director of the center? And yet you're fighting with these very people that have the life and death over every proposal you were making for courses, for add-ons, for going after the line item, et cetera.
Well, it was delicate. It was delicate because I spent about the first 3 years of my directorship just fighting with the university, sending proposals, asking for money for this, or asking that this person be hired, for, you know, with very, very limited success. You know, I don't have any money. That's the constant lament I heard. Great ideas, great programs. You're doing a great job. We just don't have any money. So then,
is that how you turn that around to get permission to go lobby the legislature on your own?
No, they never gave me. They never gave me permission. I never told them. I talked with Roman. Roman and I essentially worked it out.
And, well, surely they knew you were lobbying the legislature.
Well, you have to submit requests for line items. And, you know, but, you know, a lot of people submit requests for line items, and the university ranks it in terms of priority. And the only ones they pay attention to are the top 10. And mine was always like, you know, 12 or 13 or 14. And so what happened is the first time I submitted the request, it went through, it was turned down. But when the university's budget went through appropriations, when Roman was on the appropriations committee, he tagged the budget. And he took $160,000 away from another unit on campus and gave it to us. Well, that got the university's attention. And they got pissed off. Right, and they call me in and bring my butt out, saying I was politicizing the budget, and this other unit was pissed off. And I played though. I'm so sorry, you know, but I didn't give a damn. Except when they told me that I was politicizing my budget, that made me angry. I said, "Look, I've been coming to you guys for almost 4 years asking for money, and every time I ask for money, you guys tell me no, you don't have any. Yet I see all these other things happen. That's not political. And now I go and use one of our representatives to help me get some money, and all of a sudden that's political." I said, you know, I just reject the argument, you know. I'm sorry if so-and-so got mad. You know, that's not my intent. My intent is to try to build this program, and I can't get the internal support. So I did the only thing that I thought was feasible. So then they got mad at me, okay. So then the next thing was that, well, Roman had illegally tagged the budget, and I wasn't going to get my money. Well, that made Roman mad. Right, so then Roman and Bishop get into it, right? And Roman just tells me, and I was in the office because Roman had him on the speakerphone. The president didn't know I was there. No, and he just tells the president, you know, that he didn't appreciate his questioning his competency as a legislature, that he knew damn well what it was doing, and that Mexican American Studies had better get this money. And the president says, well, you know, the president's acting very authoritarian. He had his lawyers review it, and Roman says, I don't care who you have reviewing it. That money had better stay there. But his attorneys told him, no, that was a legitimate amendment. The budget is passed. That's law. It must go to Mexican American Studies. Well, then the president called me back up, and he sends word down to me. And I didn't understand what he was saying at the time. Now I do. Did it make any difference where my money came from? Because he was getting a lot of pressure from the unit the money was taken away from. Did it make any difference where I got my money? And I didn't understand exactly what he was saying. So what do you mean, does it make any difference? Yeah, does it make any difference where you get this $180,000? And I said, no, as long as I get it, fine. So he went to something called Melrose Thompson Funds, which is one of their royalties, and took $180,000 and gave it to me. Well, but this is the catch. I learned.
You were not allowed to have any more.
Well, I wasn't a line item there either, remember? He had tagged the budget, yeah. But this is where the catch comes in. With that money, if I hire somebody because it's not state money, that means I've got to pay off benefits. So it's not only say I'm paying you $30,000, it's $30,000 plus. Whereas if I pay state, if it's state funds, the state picks up the benefits, you know, the retirement and the, you know, all that stuff. Well, that's what I learned, right? So then the next 2 years, but that was fine. I mean, you know, I was stuck. I had agreed to it. And David Feldman and Roman and I felt like all three of us were running the program, you know, because David is advising me legally, Roman is advising me, you know. So I got the money. I cleared with Roman. You might say, no, I didn't mind. He didn't understand it either at the time. But this is what happened. 2 years later, when my request for a line item went in, you should have seen the respect that I got. It was number three in priority all of a sudden, right? And what angered the university is that I didn't trust these guys that they would look after my line item. So I would go up there on my own without telling anybody. And I would just show up there and the university's lobbyists would be there and they would get mad and send notes back to the university. So I was always in some sort of hot water. But then they began to include me. They would have these sessions, these legislative sessions on who was going to go up there. Then I started being included in their meetings. Then I started being included in the, when they sent a delegation to Austin, then I started being included in that. Then they started asking me to help to talk to Roman, to help the university's budget.
Other items,
yeah. Well, sure. Then they started coming to see, because then by this time, it was Roman and about four or five other Chicanos that were on the Appropriations Committee, plus a couple of African-Americans. So the minority component became very important, and then the university started coming to me and said, you know, we're really worried about faculty here. You know, we're really working for your line item. We wonder, could you talk to Roman here or talk, you know. So it became to be a very reciprocal kind of relationship. And then finally we got the line item.
What was it then?
Oh, gosh, I can't recall exactly what the figure was. It was modest, you know, $100,000 a year for a couple of years, you know, a couple of hundred thousand.
What's it now?
Well, it's approaching, maybe it's over $1 million now.
The line item.
The line item itself. But see, now, this is the other political issue that came up. We get the line item. Well, one of the first things I do is start expanding. We establish the Visiting Scholars Program. We move from one college career day a year to two or three a year. You know, I start agitating for larger space. Now I've got money, right, to get into a larger space. So I start agitating for that and so forth. So things started happening. And you could begin to feel that we were growing. I mean, you know, we were out of our space and students were coming around. I had visiting scholars, etc. Well, in the meantime, the director of African American Studies was a guy named John Ndakwa, who was an African.
Can you spell that?
Ndakwa. I-N-D-A-W-K-A.
Okay.
And John Ndakwa goes to Africa, returns to his home country, allegedly, for Christmas holidays. And he never comes back. Nobody knows what's happened to him. There's rumors that something fatal happened to him. There's rumors that he's in prison over there in some political situation. There's rumors that he's in Morocco. Nobody knows what happens to him. And nobody can contact him. His wife is here in the United States, doesn't know what happened to him. To this day, I don't know what happened to John Ndakwa. But to make a long story short, they closed the doors on African American Studies. They shut the program down. It was in a weakened position anyway, much like we would have been without resources. Okay, but they shut the doors.
They never got a line item?
The doors remained shut for almost a year and a half. While at the same time, I'm announcing we're doing this, I'm announcing this, I'm announcing that Arnoldo de Leon has finished his visiting scholar, we're publishing this book, I'm announcing, you know, and, you know, getting publicity, getting my publicity that I need. So then Pickering, who is the dean at that time, James Pickering, calls me in and says, you have a political issue. I said, what do you mean a political issue? He says, well, read this document. And it's a document that Elwin Lee, who is now Vice President for Student Enrollment Services.
Law professor.
Right.
Husband of the Congresswoman,
right.
Sheila Jackson.
Right. Lee. They had circulated a document among BLN, BLN, Black Leadership Network, criticizing the University of Houston for singling out Mexican-American studies for development to their detriment. That we had been singled out, that we had gotten this money, that we were doing all these things. And so Pickering had gotten the document, had been asked to respond to it. And so Pickering called me in and shared the document with me and says, what do you think we ought to do? And I said, well, I think I ought to meet with Elwin Lee and get, you know, the university has not given me money. And Pickering knew about the tenure case. Pickering knew what I had gone through to get the line item. And Pickering says, well, I was hoping you'd say that. He says, because I think you're the appropriate person to sit down with those folks and tell them what happened. So that's what I did. I met with the leadership of Black Leadership Network and spent about 2 hours explaining the whole thing. My tenure case, how that, you know, my fights to get the line item, and that the university had not given me anything, that in fact it had been political pressure. And see, they didn't know any of this. And so then
they wrote the letter anyway.
Well, yeah, you know, because on the surface it looked like we had been singled out and not them. And so, you know, they just changed their attitudes. Elwood and I became very good friends as a result. And personally, he says, well, I hope that I did not cause you any grief. He says, but I want you to understand it had nothing to do with you personally. He says, in fact, he says, you know, we kind of admire the way you've just been pushing and pushing and pushing, and had figured that you had been successful in pressuring these folks to give you money. I said, no, they haven't given me anything. Like, you know, in fact, you know, they fought me all the way on the line item, but, you know, we got it now, you know. He says, no, I understand that. And so, you know, he withdrew his statement, and we had a big meeting with the Black Leadership Network where everything was explained to them. They understood then what happened. They didn't know anything about the tenure case. They didn't know anything about the politics behind the line item. Well, so then, of course, what happens the next time around, our request for our line item keeps increasing. And the next time around, it's proposed to me that rather than fighting for another line item, and our line item is very strange because while I'm pressing Roman and I become good friends over this process. You got Pacheco.
Downtown campus.
Yeah, Manuel Pacheco, who's president of the downtown campus, who is also pushing Roman to get him some line items. Items. Not item. Items. Okay? And the downtown campus sits in Roman's district. Our campus doesn't. So when we got the line item, Roman administratively put it at the downtown campus. Right? With the agreement that 20% would stay there, 80% would come to our campus for the program. And he worked it out with Pacheco saying, you know, Manuel, I want to help you, but you know, I promised Thacho this, and we've been trying this for a couple of sessions. You know, and I want to help you too, but you know, the bulk of the money I promised to Thacho, so why don't we do this? You keep 20%, give 80%, sign off on an agreement. Manuel was glad, you know, he gets some money, and I'll get some money. And that's the way it started. Well, then, rather than the university came to me, Pickering again called me in and said, African-American Studies, now that they know you got your line item, they want the same thing. How would you feel about splitting your line item? And my immediate reaction was, well, you know, we don't have enough to split. You know, he says, well, if we can extract a promise from the university to lobby for X amount and we get it, will you split it with them? You won't, in fact, you won't lose anything. You know, it sounded like a good deal. I would continue to get an increase, and we split it. And I said, well, for me, I think, I said, first of all, you know, my first reaction is no. I said, but politically, I think it's the wise thing to do. Because, you know, African-American Studies is not going to go away. Elwin Lee, because of their agitating, had been appointed interim director. And he was the one who went in and opened up the doors again and was getting it all done. And I says, and politically it's the best thing. I said, but I'm going to catch some flack from the faculty. He says, well, how much flack? I said, well, quite a bit, because they're not going to want to split the resources. They're going to want to know why we have to split them. He says, well, what should we do? And I said, well, I'll take it to them. I think there's some faculty there that will work with it. I said, but there's going to be some that oppose it. And I said, the selling point is that the line item is going to grow exponentially to a large amount so that both programs are getting their share. And he says, well, you know, Pickering, I really scored a lot of good points with him because he thought, you know, that I was being the diplomat and seeing the larger picture and so forth and so on and not wanting to have, you know, ethnic conflict on campus, etc. So that's what happened. I took it back to the faculty, and it's just, I expected, you know, some people, you know, no, hell no, why should we share our money and blah, 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 and blah, blah, blah. But to make a long story short, you know, I showed them figures and said, you know, it's going to be this big, we'll still have a good increase, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the way it started. The first year it was split 65-35. The second time we got a line item was split 60-40. And then after that, 50-50. Everything that comes to campus is 50-50.
And I can assume the bulk was Mexican American Studies.
Yes, 60. We had 65, they had 35, then we had 60, they had 40, then 50-50.
Did the downtown campus ever develop a similar program or ever use their share to start any seed money and grant? To this day, they have nothing?
Nothing. And I don't know why.
And it's been headed by a Mexican-American president for at least two or three times. No?
Yeah, but, yeah, that's right.
And currently, there's Max Castillo.
Max Castillo. Now, the three-way arrangement has caused some problems. One of the problems is that they cut deals and increase the amount down there without us knowing.
Like, right? Oh, so to this day, 20% stays there.
Well, no, it's creeped up to 28%. It's creeped up to 28%. See, that's been one of the issues. That's been one of the issues. They sit down and they'll work it out among themselves, and we're not involved until the thing passes. Then, you know, when it's divvied up, I'll find out. And so the last time it happened, I raised a lot of hell about it, saying, you know, come on, this is just not right. You know, I mean, the 28% didn't hurt us because every time the pie kept getting bigger, I kept getting more and more money. And as you know, you got money, you got to spend it, right?
That's right.
That's damn right.
$1 million a year, that takes
right.
a lot of work.
You're damn right. You know, and you got to spend it in 2 years or it reverts back. And long does it revert back, it makes your program look like you don't really need it. You're asking for too much. But the last time it happened, which was several years ago, I raised hell about it. By this time, Pickering was president. And Pickering understood, you know, he went from president to being provost to being, I mean, from dean to provost to president. So when he got up there, I took it to him. I said, Jim, you know what goes on here. This is not right. And he agreed. He understood. He says, I'll take care of it. And so at that time, they were at like clamoring for 40%. And I says, no way. So we settled on 28. And that's the way it's been for the last two or three sessions, 28%. But I've got to watch them every year. Like this year, for example, everybody agrees on the amount that you're supposed to get. Then Max Castile comes in and says, and I'm going to add $200,000 on top of that for my little project over here. Well, I don't know anything about it. I don't hear anything about it. We get the line item and it's divvied up. 28% goes there and the remainder comes here and it's split 50-50 between African American Studies and I. But then Max discovers, hey, this $200,000 that was supposed to go to me, that wasn't supposed to be split up that way. Right? And I'm complaining. I'm saying, you know, you can't be using our line item to piggyback on stuff. You know, no, that's just not right. I'm sorry that it was split up this way. So I don't know what's going to happen on that. But, you know, I could lose a little money now because the president's supposed to decide now what's going to happen to this extra money. And I'm saying, what extra money? I wasn't told. I said, first of all, in principle, I disagree. Like, you know, I can't let engineering or somebody come and piggyback on our line item. No. Or the downtown campus. Yeah, but it's going to be used for the Hispanic Resource Center. I said, well, you know, that's all well and good. It's the principle of the thing. And so
now, this Hispanic Resource Center is what he's doing downtown?
Yeah. He wants to take it off of soft money and put it on this line item money.
And what is that?
Oh, it's a clearinghouse for scholarships and colleges for the, you know, students who want to go to college and you don't have a central location. It's a grand idea. You can go down there and they have a staff that will, you know, assess where you want to go and help you find scholarship money and help you apply, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's a good idea. Just that I shouldn't be.
Well, you also lost Romana's representative.
Well, I have.
And what did you substitute and what politics and problems did you have after that?
Well, by the time we get around to splitting the line item with African American Studies, there are more African American on the Appropriations Committee, principally Sylvester Turner and Garnet Coleman. And I come off looking like a very good guy because I'm willing to split the funds. So it solidifies my relationship with them. But Oman gets defeated in running for Senate, as you well know. But by this time, the line item has become a routine item. And, for example, this last legislative session, I only went up to Austin one time to look after it. Because, you know, it's everybody understands we're always third or fourth priority. You know, nobody's messing with it now. You know, the program has done it. The program has really bought the University of Houston a lot of goodwill with the Mexican-American Legislative Caucus. Because, you know, they see what I'm doing. Because that's all Roman was interested in. Roman said, if I help you get this money, don't you? I want you to do recruitment. You know, they're not worried about the sex life or the tsetse fly and all that research, esoteric research that we get involved in.
Is that because they came out of that private program that Leonel Castillo started sending the best and the brightest to Yale, and Romani being included?
I have no idea.
There was no place here for them.
Yeah, I have no idea. I have no idea what... Roman was, I think, you know, sincerely, Roman was my entree into that group. Up until Roman got elected, I couldn't get to first base with Al or Ben who had been had been elected up there, or that whole little clique. You know, just wouldn't give me the time of day, because we had run against Maria Jimenez, against Ben, as you well know.
Who is we?
The Rasta Unida Party.
Okay.
Here in Harris County.
Well, you want to go back and pick up that piece? You got about 5 minutes, or do you want to finish the according to your time clock?
Yeah.
Or do you want to finish this last part that we're on? Because you did have problems with Senator Gallegos, and that's been resolved.
Well, those problems came about as a result of Roman running against Mario for Senate. And of course I'm going to support Roman. Roman comes and asks me for his support. By this time I'm into political analysis. I've got a fairly good command of the precincts and turnout by precinct at this time. And at this point, I was right into it. You know, I knew, and I was helping Roman. And I had done, what started it all is that part of that district, that Senate district that Mario now represents, includes District H, City Council District H, which is now held by Felix Fraga. And I was doing some exit polls in that district. And on my own, I included a question on the Senate race. And there were three people running: Roman, Yolanda Navarro, and Mario. And my question was, you know, who would you vote for? And then I paired them. If Mario and Roman run, who wins? If Mario and Yolanda runs, who wins? If Yolanda and Mario runs, who wins? Well, Mario, and I understand why he saw it, because he knew that I was close to Roman, thinks that I did this for Roman, first. Second of all, he doesn't believe the statistics. The statistics show that Roman would win, that he would beat Roman, he would beat Mario and beat him in a runoff. And so Mario, you know, hit the ceiling. He goes, you know, and I'm writing articles this time. I'm writing two articles a month for Viva magazine. And I'm using a lot of stuff that I got. So I write an article on this particular race, what I found in the exit poll when they ran. Well, where I screwed up, and I thought I was doing the right thing, is I called Yolanda, and I called Roman, and I called Mario, and told them each, hey, I'm writing this article just so that you'll know, when, you know, you're all my friends, and I'm publishing, well, what did you find? And I told them. Well, Mario hits the ceiling, of course. And he calls the Houston Post, he calls the president, he calls Gene Green, he's got, you know, everybody in the world calling the president that I'm doing this slanted research, that, you know, I'm biased, and I'm trying to help Roman, I'm using my position as the director of Mexican American Studies to help Roman, and he calls Blanca, he calls, that this time it's Gerald Garcia, who was one of the news editors down at the Houston Post, he calls it, I mean, I've got a lot of pressure on me, and I almost pulled the article. But as things went on, you know, I just said, no, I'm not going to pull it, man. Because, you know, Roman didn't ask me to do this. I'm not lying. I'm not cheating. But Mario's saying it's an invalid poll because you didn't cover the whole district. Right? You only went to District H. But I was very upfront. I said that in the article. This is a partial look. But some of the major and the largest Hispanic precincts are in this area. Some of the Anglos are in this area. And I was very explicit in the article. Well, I mean, you know, Blanca didn't know what to do. She was all pressured, you know, because Mario was
calling... She's the editor.
She was the editor of Viva magazine. Yeah, and Mario was calling her people who advertise in Viva, and was calling the Houston Post. You know, there was a lot of pressure on her. And so, you know, I got back and reviewed everything, made sure I was correct. I even went so far as to call Kent Tanine and Dick Murray in political science and saying, hey, without telling the politics, saying, this is what I did. How bad is it? Should I do this? How bad is it? And Murray said, yeah, it's a partial view. Yes, do it. You know, so that kind of made me feel a little bit more comfortable. But with hindsight, it caused me a lot of grief.
Well, how did you work it out? How did you patch it up?
Well, first of all, Mario and I had been friends for almost 20, 25 years, before he was even an elected politician. You know, we used to drink beer together at Sweet Jello's, and I used to help him when he was with the Hispanic firefighters with their fundraisers. You know, I'd go to all their functions, and he was very politically active, and we had that in common. Every time we'd talk politics and who's doing what to this, and so we were friends. And I just refused to allow this to come in between us, so I just kept calling him. Just kept calling him, and I ran into him a couple of times, and I pinned him down, and Mario, you know, this is bullshit. We've been friends for too long. I wouldn't put, this is, it's fine. It didn't make you look good. But it's not a scam. You know, it's nothing crooked here, you know. It's just the way it came out. If you would have come out ahead, I would have published it. And Roman would have pissed me, you know, would have been pissed off at me. I said, but I would have still done it. You know, no, I thought you were chicken shit. You turned your back on me. We've been friends a long time, and you know that I wasn't on the Appropriations Committee, but you know I always supported your line item, man, you know. And he was, I mean, in a way, I guess he was genuinely hurt. Thought that I had thought so much of Oman that I would finagle the statistics and, you know, and so forth and so on. And so, well, of course, he beat Roman, you know, and but I wrote a follow-up article, which I kept telling him. I wrote a follow-up article. My opening sentence was, did Mario Gallegos win this election as much as Roman Martinez lost it? Which I think he did. And then Roman gets pissed off at me, right? Because I said that about him, you know. And I keep telling Mario, see, you know, what the hell? Yeah, but you ain't got nothing to lose with Roman anymore. I said, the hell I don't, man. He's a friend of mine, you know. The hell? You know, I don't want to, you know, I'm trying to be an analyst, Mario. You know, and I've got to, you know, I can't be, you know, saying stuff, you know, and so forth and so on. And no, you know, you chicken shit, and I ain't gonna ever forget it. I ain't ever gonna forget it. And of course, when he got elected, you know, but he left my line item alone. He left my line item alone, even though he continued to complain. Every time he'd see somebody from the university, he'd complain. Or if we sent a group of students somewhere, he'd complain. But what helped me a lot, you know what helped me a lot on him, is that he likes Lorenzo a lot. And so he would bend Lorenzo's ear. That damn Thatcher turned his back on that chicken shit and blah, 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 you know. And Lorenzo would just listen and listen and listen. So if I ever wanted to get any messages back to Mario, I'd all go through to Lorenzo without him telling me.
And Lorenzo's your assistant.
My assistant, the associate director of the program. He's been
with
me.
Been there.
Well, you know, one of the few times that I was able to get money from Magna and was I got $20,000. And the first thing I did was I wanted to hire Lorenzo. I wanted him, you know, I knew how he was. I knew I could trust him. I knew, you know, he had the same sort of commitment to the program that I did. So I hired him.
You've never been accused of being too staff-heavy and having too many people?
I've never been too staff-heavy. Never.
Well, I understand your view. I'm asking if you've been criticized for
it. No, never. Never been too staff-heavy. Uh-uh. I don't think the budget, you know, would pan that out. So I called Lorenzo in. I told him I wanted to hire him to do some recruiting. I said, but I got $20,000. I can pay you the whole $20,000, and you do all the running around to the schools. Or I can pay you $17,000. We leave $3,000, just like I did with you, Mr. Scott. I leave $3,000 aside, and we'll use that $3,000 to hire you a good student to help you do the running around the clerical stuff. And he chose the second option. He said, "No, hell, I'm going to need some more. I'm going to help." So that's what we did. I hired Lorenzo. That was my first hire. And you know, he's good. He's good. He does.
Well, let's leave this for a while. Why don't you just spend a few more minutes, as long as you can, giving us some biography. You know, I mean, who's Thatcher Mignola? Who are your parents? Where did they come from? What are their names? Who are your children? Your wife? Some biographical information so we know the
person. Well, I was born here in Houston, Texas, 1939. I'm 58 years old. One of five sons. One of six children. I have a sister. My dad was a baker. My mom a housewife, but she helped him in the bakery when he had his own bakery.
Can we get some names here?
My dad's Anastasio Mendiola Sr. My mom is Hortensia Rocha Mendiola. My oldest brother, who has now passed away, was Armando. Then my brother Gilbert. Then me. Then my brother Robert. Then my sister Dolores. Then my brother Ronnie. I grew up in the Heights area, what they call the Sunset Heights, over near North Main Street, in between 28th and 29th. I went to Alamo Elementary. This is ironic. I started at Alamo and finished at Brown.
Did you go to Travis and Bowie?
No, I didn't. But there is Austin, a Travis and a Bowie here, right? So I go to elementary, you know, to Alamo Elementary, Hamilton Junior High at that time. Now it's middle school, they call it, and then to Reagan Senior High. And then after Reagan, I enrolled in college, wanted to go to school, but wasn't a very good student.
Curiosity. The father's name was Anastasio. Didn't they name you Anastasio? Or did they name you Tacho?
No, Anastasio is my name.
Oh, so really, your birth certificate, that's why you had the junior to it.
Yeah, junior. I'm a Tacho. I mean, but my dad has never been Anastasio. He's always been Tacho. So, you know, that the tag was on me.
But you also spelled it unusually with a T.
Well, again, I get that from my dad.
That's how he spelled it.
That's how he spelled it.
I see.
It's very interesting that you would raise that, because recently I had an uncle, 90 years old. He was my dad's first cousin, Paul Mendiola. Two first cousins, my dad and my Uncle Paul, married two sisters, Hortensia and Beatriz. In the same family, a Paul family, see, and this whole thing about M-I versus M-E.
Yeah.
Did I tell you the story?
No, but yeah. I was going to ask you next about that. Well, if your birth name is incorrect, about the second
right.
Name.
Well, so I've always figured it was just a misspelling. But I know there are some MIs in Houston, there are some MIs in California, and I can trace them. They're all related, and I know there's some MEs. So my Uncle Paul dies a couple of weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, and we're at his son's house, who is an MI. Okay? And there are some other Mendiolas there who are ME, including my Uncle Kelly and my Uncle Dennis, who are my Uncle Paul's brothers. And my Uncle Dennis spells his ME, my Uncle Kelly, MI. Right?
Something's wrong.
Right. Well,
unless Grandpa had Mendiola, well, that's his last name.
Well, and there are a couple of elderly tías there in their 70s who are MI. So I go over there, you know, we're drinking beer, and I go over and introduce him myself, you know, and the uncles I hardly ever see. I haven't seen them since I was a kid. And I raise this question. Who's right? How did this stuff start? MI and ME. And my Uncle Kelly, who is MI, looks at my Uncle Dennis and says, he's spelling his name wrong. And my Uncle Dennis is M.E., says, that's not true. You guys are spelling it wrong. Says, it's always been M.E. And my Uncle Paul says, no, it's always been M.I. You guys, isn't it? Because Theo, they're one of their uncles that somebody came across and had a dispute in the family. And one of them changed their name, right? Now, I don't know if it was an M.I. who changed it to M.E. or an M.E. who changed to M.I. But there we've got two brothers in the same family spelling their names differently. Then they've got some daughters there. The same thing. One of them chose to spell their M-I, one of them chose to spell it M-E. So while all of this is going on, the debate is going back and forth, and I've got a couple of cousins there. This is some serious stuff with my cousins, too. They get into it. They're arguing about, no, don't you remember so-and-so? And then my other cousin says, well, when we were in California, there comes somebody from Montana. He claims he's a Mendiola, and he's spelling his name M-I. And we said, nobody knows who he is. So somebody says, who in the hell are you? And he says, well, my name is so-and-so Mendiola from Montana, and I heard you guys are having a reunion. I want to know where my relatives are, right? While all this is going on, there's one of my elderly tías there, and she says, and to make things worse, it's not even a Mexican name. And so I perk up. I said, what do you mean it's not even a Mexican name? She says, well, your grandfather, Vicente Mendiola, who was M.I., he was adopted. His daddy, your great-great-grandfather, adopted him, and he was an Italian who married his mother, and his name was Mendiola. And then she says, with an I. I mean, it was hilarious. So I took everybody's name down there, and I'm going to go interview them. I've got to interview them. They're already in their 80s. If I don't get this story done, plus she told me that my Uncle Paul has a sister in California who's also very elderly. She couldn't make it to the funeral because she can't travel. She's got a family tree that starts with whoever this MI was, and she's claiming that he's from Italy. So I don't know where, but I found it very, very interesting that within the same family, you know, we've got people, one of them MI, one's ME, and it's a matter of dispute. You know, it's a matter of dispute.
Well, where did the grandparents come from, and when did they cross over?
My grandfather on my dad's side crossed over when he was about 6. I don't know. I don't know the details of that.
Was your dad born here?
Yeah, my dad was born in Beaumont, Texas.
You know when he was born?
Yeah, my dad was born. Let's see, he was 84. He was born in 1902, I think. And my mom, on my mom's side, my grandfather on my mom's side was a Tejano. He was born here. Now, I've got the Rochas a little bit more pinned down. And they're all from around the border area, you know, Coahuila and so forth and so on, the Rochas. And my great-great-great-grandfather, I've got some stuff on him.
That's the Italian?
No, he's a Rocha. He's a Rocha.
This is on the maternal side.
Yeah, on the maternal side, right. He's a Rocha.
Okay.
So I can trace that down to my mom. It's on my dad's side where it's all confusing. But I'm pleased, though, that this MI thing may not be a misspelling. It may have to do with a family dispute.
Mm-hmm.
Or it may be Italian.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be a whole lot of MEs out there that I'm related to that I don't know about.
What do you see as the main differences in meeting others of you being raised as an urban Mexican-American?
Well, I think the black influence and the white influence is heavier here when I was growing up than, say, in South Texas or San Antonio, et cetera, et cetera.
Did you also live in proximity to blacks?
Yes.
Was that physical enforcement, segregated barrios and things of that sort, or
no,
economics? That's where you could afford to rent and buy.
Well, when my dad bought the house out there where he lived, it was on the outskirts of Houston, and just a couple of blocks over was where what we used to say back then, Nigger Town started. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the church we used to go to, it's about 4 or 5 blocks from my house, was divided. Blacks sat on one side and whites and Mexicans on the other side.
And are you all Catholics or Presbyterians?
Yeah, Catholics,
or Methodists?
Catholics.
Did you go through all those rituals, all the communion and baptism?
I went through communion. I haven't been confirmed. I'm baptism and communion, but I haven't been confirmed.
Of course, you've got children. Who are your children? And you know, when
my oldest child is Anastasio Mendiola III. Then I've got twin daughters, Maribel and Maricela. And then I've got a little one, Gilbert.
What are the ages of these children? Are you a grandfather yet? Or?
No, hell no. Trey is 19, the girls are 18, and Gilbert is 6.
Oh, why are you so emphatic with the hell no?
No, they're too young. They're in college. Listen, I'm going to have to get. I've got an interview.
All right.
But we can finish this if you want.
Okay, well, I do want, because we need to get some other
background.
Things. So. But I'm going to send this in for copying and dubbing and all now, because who knows when I'll catch you next. But thank you anyway.
All right.